This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with David Berube. He's a professor of speech communications at the University of South Carolina. And recently I ran across on the web his essay on nano-socialism and his ideas about why nanotechnology, both for its fruition, requires state democratic intervention, and also in its outcome and its products for our society, why it will require a more egalitarian and democratically organized society. Welcome, David Berube.
Thank you.
So first, let's introduce some of our listeners to the concept of nanotechnology. What do you mean when you talk about nanotechnology?
Well, the word just refers to any technology that is incredibly small. Nano comes from the Greek word dwarf. It means about, as a prefix, a billionth. So where we would say that we're talking about meters, a nanometer would be a billionth of a meter. And so what we're talking in terms of nanotechnology is pretty much any technology at that level. The way it's used in the literature really depends who you're reading. But a lot of the people who are writing in the field, especially those with technical degrees, refer to construction on the molecular level. In other words, taking molecules and moving them up and wetting them against other molecules, causing them to bond, but bond in a configuration that you actually want to happen versus what happens in the natural environment.
So Eric Drexler is one of the names that has been advancing this concept of nanotechnology. And Drexler's concept is that we'll be able to make machines which also have computerized aspects at the molecular and submolecular level. How could we possibly do that? Because molecules are the building blocks of all of our current machines.
Well, I mean, bonds break. They do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what you need to do is develop the technical ability to break bonds on command and then move molecules in approximation so they bond together. I mean, enzymes break, you know, down compounds all the times into molecules. And every time a molecule breaks off from another, it tends to have something they refer to as a sticky end. And if it meets another molecule with a cooperative sticky end, then they bond together. And so, I mean, there's nothing in the law of physics that would make this impossible. Of course, there's an incredible amount of technological development that would have to take place for it to become something that we would see on a day-to-day basis.
Where are we with the current research that's being done on the micro-mechanical scale?
We have microelectronics I guess we call them nanoelectronics. We have electronic devices that function on a nano scale. The head of your VCR player the head of the VCR player is grounded onto a nano level. I mean, we work at that level right now. The recent discovery in the last half decade or so of the buckyballs, which are carbon molecules that were spherical, and since then they've discovered these nanotubes, which are bucky tubes, which are cylindrical carbon molecular configurations. I mean, we're seeing a lot of discoveries, and and with electronics, we just we put more and more on less and less space, and we've just continued to do this. And there's a whole field that's opened up recently in where new computing is going to go. There's incredibly interesting research being done in computing on the quantum level, and there's also interesting research on how to use photonics or use photons as a way to communicate at that level. So, you know, periodically also, you open up a newspaper, you open up a magazine, and you always see these quaint little pictures, you know, where Time Magazine or U.S. News or something will show that someone has designed an incredibly, incredibly small vehicle or a small guitar, or even their logo on a molecular level. So there's a lot of work being done. In terms of practical applications, we're still, you know, a few decades away from it. There's no doubt that this is highly speculative as technology.
It seems like there may be convergence with genetic engineering. Some people have said that we're already using nanotechnology, and it's called genetics.
I mean, yeah, I've come across that material literature too. It just seems if you read enough into the field, you begin to discover that biotechnology is incredibly crude compared to what you could do with nanotechnology. And furthermore, if you can actually manipulate material on a molecular level, nanotechnology would be the ideal way to do biotechnology.
Now, some of the things that, if we were to achieve real molecular-scale nanotechnology, what are some of the industrial processes that would be transformed by that?
Almost everything would be transformed by that, pretty much. The good news is that you could do incredible things in terms of cleaning up the environment, because pollution is just byproducts that are not cost-effective to clean up. And when you have machines functioning at a molecular level, if you have a toxic waste slurry made up of compounds which are very injurious to the environment, then what you can do is send in your fleet of nano machines and have them take these complicated and highly destructive compounds and break them down to their molecular level and pretty much, make them more likely to be safe for the environment. I think that's the real good news. The other good news, and you see this regularly on science shows, on television, and in newscasts, is its implications in terms of medicine, because you could send your fleet of nanoprobes through the body and have it repair sites that have been damaged by disease, and it could also probably do some reconstruction. And so that's the real good side of it. I mean, in terms of industry will change entirely, because we're the way industry works, we take large things and break them down into smaller things in order for them to be useful for us. And this is a completely different way of looking at it. It's like an entirely new industrial revolution. We're not dependent on natural resources anymore. I mean, we can construct stuff from pretty much waste products. I mean, pretty much a carbon is a piece of carbon to a nanomachine. It doesn't matter whether, the carbon was mined from within the earth or else the carbon is the result of a waste product. And so it completely changes the industrial process, because you're building from the bottom up rather than from the top down.
We could really have alchemy. We could change the the material, the element, one element to another.
That'd be hard to do. You could, yeah. It depends upon. The thing is, it's foolish to believe that you could take any compound that's complex and break it into molecules and then expect them to be reconstructed into every possible configuration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are limits to what you can do, but there's an incredible amount you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it would just be remarkable in terms of how it would change things.
Some of the folks in science fiction who speculate about the effects of nanotechnology suggest, for instance, back to medicine, that we could have our bodies full of a secondary mechanical immune system that would identify any signs of aging or any cells that were cancerous and eliminate them preemptively.
Sure.
So there are a lot of different possible applications. Now, your argument is that one of your contentions in the article Man of Socialism is that capitalism does not have an incentive to develop these technologies. And let's start with your argument that nanoproducts won't require replacements.
Right. I mean, the entire industrial process in capitalist structures exists to maximize your profit. You do that by actually programming obsolescence into your products, so you maintain a strong aftermarket. So if, the automobile is a classic example, right? You design the automobile. Automobiles could be designed to be much more efficient than they are. We all know that. And you design them in such a way so they're only efficient enough so they would keep the consumer happy with the product, but they will break down so you control the aftermarket, so you're supplying the parts to keep the car going. There's absolutely no incentive on their part to engage in a lot of this level of innovative research. Because once you, put a bunch of nanoprobes, into an automobile to keep the automobile running, then you're really going to cut into the profit margins. And that's pretty much the most, fundamental precept of this whole issue about whether capitalist structures could actually, produce this type of technology. It's just not profitable. It's incredibly unprofitable. And for a brief period of time, and we're talking about, maybe a decade or so. Once the first nano device is developed, there'll be a period of time where, of course, they'll be incredibly expensive. you know, and they'll, and of course, most people won't be able to get them, and they'll be restricted to government institutions and certain industries. But after a while, you know, they will become less and less expensive and more available, just like computer chips are everywhere now.
Well, you know, the computer is a good example for this because my computer or any computer will probably last 6-7 years. Mm-hmm. But long before 6-7 years come around, I will want to buy a new one because the technological advance from the computer manufacturers make it absolutely necessary for me to get the latest upgrade.
Sure.
So it seems like there are ways that capitalism, you're kind of underestimating capitalism and corporate firms' ability to design into the innovative process ways that they could make profits off of upgrades, service agreements, or actually to plan obsolescence into the product itself. You know, that one of the big concerns people have with nanotechnology is that if it doesn't have a built-in time clock to say you will stop working and stop doing what you're doing at some point,
sure,
that they could get loose and really wreak havoc on things.
Right. I mean, there's some people who suggest that they could, you know, pretty much devour the environment if they were let out.
Mm-hmm.
We've said the same thing about transgenic crops, however, and that really didn't happen.
Right.
You know, but I think the understanding is, industry would have to have an incredible level of control to be able to produce the profit margins they want while introducing a technology that's this radical. And the way the world has changed in terms of it becoming incredibly globalized, where we have access to, everyone has access to incredible levels of information and technology, that hole doesn't exist anymore. It did in the beginning of the 20th century, but it doesn't at the beginning of the 21st century. The beginning of the 20th century, the way, you know, when the first automobiles came out, they were just magical. Very, very few people even understood how they worked. And now it's pretty easy to learn about how anything works with a diligent individual spending, you know, a few hundred hours. It's not that hard. And once these nano devices actually hit the market, somebody will be smart enough to take these nano devices and find other applications for it. And those other applications is what scares the hell out of the industrial market.
Now, you're also bringing up the issue of intellectual property and patent law, that once a product is out there, someone can reverse engineer it. But we have that issue currently with semiconductors and all kinds of products and processes, that people who reverse engineer a semiconductor and decide to make their own and sell it have to prove a pretty high standard of that they have not ripped off the basic underlying technology, that they've recreated it.
The thing about semiconductors, which makes it a little different from like nanotechnology, is semiconductors are very specialized in terms of, you know, their application. Nanotechnology doesn't need to be. I mean, these nanobots, these small molecular construction vehicles, can be very generalized in their application, and it's really hard to, you know, patent a generalized anything that's that generalized, and as such, I mean, the state trying to restrict people taking nano devices and taking a nano device that may have been very specific and turning to a more generalized one, or taking a generalized one and using it for something else, will be incredibly difficult to try to control. Never mind the fact that on the international market, it'll be almost impossible. Once this hits out, people are going to reverse engineer, and before you know it, there'll be a plant in Thailand doing them.
I guess I'm more pessimistic about the ability of mega corporations through the World Trade Organization and the dominance of the first world over the third to bring those kind of pressures to bear. I mean, you see that those kind of pressures being brought to bear on China,
sure,
where they have to round up bootleg CDs and so
yeah,
forth. Not very effectively, grant you, but...
Right, but I mean, we've always been led to believe that if something is going to be potentially dangerous or potentially destructive, that the government would step in and like regulate it. And this is one of those technologies that it'd be incredibly difficult to try to regulate it.
Yeah. Now, one of the sociological arguments that's kind of implicit in your article, and that I want to just make more explicit, Marx argued that capitalism is a revolutionary social organization that develops the means of production, in this case, develops the industrial process of nanotechnology. And it develops it to a point where it will make obvious to us all the contradiction between the private ownership of that industrial process and the industrial and the social relations of the fact that the the industrial process is one that it doesn't make any sense for it to be privately owned. One of the ways in which that will be, that contradiction will be brought forward, is that you can't make any more industrial process through private ownership. And so you'll have to have collective ownership or state intervention of some kind in order to make more industrial process. So there seems to be implicit in your argument that kind of an argument as well. But of course, the problem is when is capitalism still revolutionary and when has it been stalled by its own internal contradictions? You're arguing that with nanotechnology, we would reach that place where corporations would try very hard to sabotage the development of true nanotechnology.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they have every incentive to. It makes very little sense for them to invest in this type of technology. This type of technology is probably, truth be told, this type of technology is probably first going to become apparent out of military-related research. And, I mean, there's enough indications that is likely. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's where it'll first appear.
Just like genetic engineering.
Sure. You know, and I mean all the major developments of the internet, you know, that have hit us, that really have changed the way almost paradigm shaking introductions have been out of government related research and a lot of military related research. That's probably where it's going to come out first, and then industrial applications could follow. But industry is just going to balk at this because of its generalized effect. I mean, if this is true, and you can make almost anything out of anything out of carbon, for example, if you just have build stuff on a level out of carbon, once you develop these generalized fleet of these nanobots and they become available, I mean, the value of labor decreases substantially, right? I mean, we need a lot of people to do all the stuff we need to get the products into the shape we need them in and get them into our hands so we can use them. But I mean, if we have generalized nanotechnology capabilities, then I mean, we just don't need that type of workforce anymore, right? That's going to be incredibly challenging.
Well, I think what you raise is the difference between capitalism being rational at the collective executive level and being irrational at the micro level. In other words, you know, Xerox PARC didn't foresee how irrational it was for them not to capitalize on the Macintosh technology. They were invested in their own things, and they didn't want to do that.
Right.
Apple took it and ran with it and nearly revolutionized the computer industry, nearly wiped out IBM. So, you know, for me, I can easily imagine a small biotech startup firm doing the necessary research to develop a cancer-fighting nanobot,
right,
releasing it onto the market. You know, people would give their right arm and leg in order to have this thing. They would make huge mega profits. And what kind of corporate shenanigans could their rivals, you know, the makers of chemotherapy and radiation therapies, come up with that would really, you know, put deep six them? I can't imagine the scenario.
Well, I mean, there are a whole bunch of possibilities.
Yeah.
I mean, initially, I presume what they're going to do is try to debunk it, which they've already, you know, done fairly well.
Yeah.
And just say, this is foolish. I would presume probably one out of every two articles or bits of information you get on the nanotechnology is just insulting rhetoric,
uh-huh,
which says this is just incredibly fanciful, it'll never get here. And I mean,
critical,
this type of that's probably the first thing that would happen.
Ed Regis's book was pretty.
Yeah, I mean, there's a handful of them that are out there that just say this is just ludicrous. It is never going to happen. Of course, you know, they said that about so many different things throughout history, which makes you really nervous when someone says never, because it usually is a pretty good indicator that it's somewhere down the line. But I mean, and after the debunking, you know, after the bunking takes place, which is what we're talking about, then the next step will be to try to sabotage the nanobots. And I mean, that can be done. I mean, that's not too hard. I mean, these things are not the strongest. I mean, if you think about it, anything that's constructed at the molecular level will be fairly rigid, but ain't going to be the strongest thing in the world. There'll be a lot of ways to make them less effective. I think what will end up happening is there will be at least an effort to buy out at that level as well. I mean, you know, they're going to do everything they can to try to slow this stuff down. I mean, I remember taking a drive in 1983 with a guy who developed a steam automobile in Sarasota, Florida, and it was bought by one of the major automobile workers, and it was just kept off the market. And that same technology, the technology they've been using in newly industrialized countries and less developed countries to generate electricity off solar panels because it's so efficient. But this type of behavior is just going to continue. And then what will end up happening is there will be a major breakthrough, but it won't be, it'll be a breakthrough that will happen from some rogue entrepreneurs, and you know, hopefully they will have a good sense of morality when they do this, because the implications of having something that can take things apart and rearrange them on a molecular level was incredibly frightening.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two parts to your argument. The first is that we would get to nanotechnology faster if we had state support and state sponsorship of research. And I think that you make a somewhat of a case there, though I'm a little bit more skeptical about corporations' ability to be collectively rational in that way. The second part of your argument is that we would need a radical reorganization of society if we actually did have nanotechnology on the scene. Now, there's some positive aspects to that, that, you know, if no one had to work anymore, then we would have to reorganize our society in a way that was more democratic, or at least it would make clear that we would be better off if we organized that way. The negative part of that argument, which you just touched upon, is that nanotechnology is such a threat to the survival of the planet, of the species, that we would need a far more authoritarian society.
Right, right. And I mean, there's people who have speculated on that, claiming that because of its dark side, that the implications are that it might produce a tendency towards much more authoritarian or totalitarian controls to try to control it. The thing is, this is not that outrageous. I mean, granted, we don't see it today. And we may not see it for 50 to 100 years, but inevitably, people are going to be able to construct stuff on the molecular level. I mean, we've done a lot of the legwork to get where we are now, and it's just a matter of time for this to come. And my argument on nanotechnology has always been, you know, this thing is probably inevitable. You know, and when it gets here, it'd be really nice if we had planned for its arrival, instead of just allowing it to happen. Because, I mean, it reminds me so much of biotoxins and bioviruses, right?
Right.
I mean, you just don't wait around to go, oh, well, guess what? We have a new outbreak. I guess we should do some research now. You know, this is the type of stuff you really plan for because of its, you know, of its dark side. And I mean, that's, I think, one of the most frightening things is just waiting around for this thing to happen. Because I'm one of the pessimists in the world who thinks that, you know, if someone's going to put this much effort into it, I don't want to really hope that they have the type of conscience that would, you know, make the world a better place, because there's a high, I mean, I'm a student of history, and I know pretty well that there's a pretty high probability that instead it'll be used for ways to wrest more power from people.
Have you had a chance to read Nancy Kress's Beggars in Spain series? She's a science fiction author who's speculated on the effects of genetic engineering and nanotech on social inequality in the United States. And her vision of it is that within 100 years, you could have a mass of people who were just basically vegetative proles who were fed by, you know, nanotech food-producing machines and watched their soap operas, and then just a very few, kind of an Ayn Randish vision, very few productive citizens.
There's very few serious academic speculations about what a true leisure society would be. Very, very, very few people have looked into this.
That's right.
And it's pretty much because we're defined by our work anyways. And so this is just such an alien concept. They haven't speculated. But a true leisure society could be fairly disorienting.
One of my favorite people who's actually written about that is Andre Gortz. He's written Pathways to Utopia and Farewell to the Proletariat, a post-Marxist vision of a social programs that would lead us to leisure. Now, you also touched on geopolitics. Can you mention briefly what you think some of the effects on geopolitics would be? I mean, one effect I can imagine is that it would be a great equalizer, because the threat the third world country would use nanotechnology and as a weapon of mass destruction would be horrific.
As an aside, before I get into it, there are people out there now, especially in the academic world in cybernetics, who've been arguing that we need something like a robotic anti-proliferation treaty, because everyone is incredibly concerned that the little machines will start fighting for the people on the battlefield, initially against other people, you know, and it probably would be the first world with their incredibly powerful robotic military technologies using it in warfare against people who are completely ill-equipped to deal with attacked by machines.
Well, if the biological and chemical weapons treaty sure. process is any guide, well, the U.S. will say that United States, France, and Britain are the only moral countries in the world that can have this technology, and everybody else is too crazy to use it.
Right, right. But I mean, if you're, I'm watching the reports. Desert Storm was bad enough to have to watch on television, but watching what's going on currently in Serbia, I mean, you begin to see the technologicalization of warfare and how warfighting is taking place. And there's a similar problem when you deal with nanotechnology, because this technology could be incredibly provocative. I mean, if you could actually turn loose on a battlefield a bunch of nanogorts that would just head out and deconstruct things on the molecular level, I mean, they could just take apart a platoon without much difficulty. And someone without a conscience could launch nanoweapons into a nation state and program them to, you know, every time they come anywhere near anything with the chemical composition H2O to deconstruct it. And, you know, just turn a wonderful nation state into a, just a terrible desert. And, you know, I mean, they're just, the applications are just in frightening in terms of where, you know, where it's going. And, I mean, the United States has spent quite a bit of money already, you know, doing research in this. You know, Admiral Jeremiah has been testifying over and over again about, you know, some of the applications of this. You know, and he talks about how great it would be if we had these type of molecular devices so we could have them, you know, release them into a nation state where we're warring against and have them turn the concrete into paste, which would destroy their airfields.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's one application, but there's a lot of other ones that could be programmed as well.
Right.
You know?
Well, another novel that I'm reading now is Will McCarthy's Bloom, and that basically the creation of nanotechnology in Bloom has turned every society into a giant immune system that they're constantly identifying and destroying with their own nanotechnology, the threat of nanotechnological infiltration. We only have 2 minutes left,
okay.
And I just wanted to say that it's a real pleasure to talk to someone about these topics who shares the full commitment to equality, solidarity, and liberty of the French Revolution, and not just liberty, because it seems like everybody out there who's thinking about nanotechnology, from Drexler to the Extropians, that they're libertarians.
Yeah. That's, yeah, you've got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they pretty much are. I think it's incredibly naive to think that this technology is going to come around and it's going to provide everybody with everything they need for democracy to be the most effective. You know, where everyone is going to get, you know, their bellies will be filled and the world will be a happy place, and we're completely competent enough to handle it with our current government structures, and we should just enjoy the ride, which makes me really nervous.
Well, I've been talking with David Berube. He's a professor of speech communication at the University of South Carolina, and you have a website, a webpage for yourself as a faculty person at www.cla.sc.edu/thsp/faculty/berube, Berube, your name, slash. And that's where people can find the article, Nanosocialism.
Sure.
And you also are working on a book on post-humanism?
Yeah, I finished a series of, I did some international presentations, I've been writing for about the last, 8 months on it. They'll probably be together in another 6. And it's just talking about what happens when man and machine merge, which is getting more and more likely with advanced medical prosthetics and robotics and genetic technologies and such. And so it's just a discussion of what happens when the ontology of the machine confronts the ontology of man. And then together one will win and the other will lose, or else they both lose, or else they merge and become completely different, which is pretty much what it's about.
The singularity.
Yep.
And we can expect that from Sage in a year or two?
Probably in a year or two.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us, David.
No problem.
Berube.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows.
the myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.